Welcome to the next episode of Tree Lady Talks, and I have been dying to say this ever since we started.
Go on then. What is it?
Here is a man who needs no introduction. So, he's going to get the longest introduction we've ever done! Who is it, Sharon?
Tony Kirkham, MBE. He's the head of the Arboretum, Gardens and Horticultural Services at the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew, one of my favourite places.
Now, you've worked there, haven't you?
Well, I did a job there a few years ago, and I just love going there.
So, he's just such a lovely, lovely man, Tony. He's very much like Joanna Lumley. I actually think he's a national treasure. And as a result of him being a national treasure, he's been on TV an awful lot, and I think the general public really know Tony.
I think they do, not only from his TV appearances, including with Dame Judy. He's written so many books as well, including recently the Haynes Workshop Manual of Trees and Remarkable Trees. So many books I know he's writing at the moment as well. And he's been really recognised in the industry as being a good chap. 2019, he got the Victoria Medal of Honour from the RHS and an MBE. So I've known Tony for years, and it was just such a joy to have this chat with him. He's just a great interviewee.
And he's done an awful lot of travelling, hasn't he? He's gone to Asia. He's done so much stuff. It's quite extraordinary how much of the globe he's actually covered. I think he could do a TV version of Around the World in 80 Trees, to be honest.
He probably could, absolutely.
There's an idea for later, Tony, for later. Anyway, I did say I was going to do a bit of a fanfare, so I'll do a bit of a fanfare. Actually, just do a bit of a fanfare right now. Hold on a second. Marvellous. Let's get on with the interview straight away. Tony Kirkham.
So welcome to Tony Kirkham, MBE, head of the Arboretum at Kew Gardens. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome, Sharon. I've been looking forward to this all week.
Oh, you're very kind. Well, so many people know you, Tony, from your TV appearances and your books. We always love to hear you speak. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I think I'm one of the lucky ones in the sense that when I was at primary school, I'd already decided then that I was going to work with trees. And I didn't know in what capacity, but I just had an affinity for them because where I grew up was quite rural. We had three municipal parks in my small town in Lancashire, and they ran onto the moors. So that was my playground when I was young. I was a scout. I was a chief scout, actually, and I loved the outdoors. But it was one moment in primary school where our teacher, Miss Beasley, Jane Beasley, I still remember her, she brought in a bunch of horse chestnut twigs in full bud. She was explaining how they were all sticky and how they were swelling and what that meant. She said, "This is a sign of spring." And these come out very quick. And this was on a Friday. She said, "On Monday, when you come into class, they'll all be in full leaf." And I just thought, nah, she might be good, but she's not that good. And I think that was the fastest I ever went into school. And I remember going up this huge staircase into that classroom and seeing these in full leaf and just thought, she was right. Absolutely amazing. And she told us about the horseshoe scars, leaf scars, why it was called the horse chestnut. And I think that captivated me. And I just thought, well, that's really interesting. And I just started looking closer at trees. My first book was given to me when I was about 10 or 11, a tree book. And the first thing I did, I went to the index to look for the longest name. And it was Metsequoia glyptostroboides.
That's trips off the tongue then.
I recited it all day. And then while we were having dinner in the evening with my parents and two sisters, halfway through, I just blurted out Metsequoia glyptostroboides. And they all looked at me in astonishment and then carried on eating. That was probably the first Latin name that I learned. And it was later in my life in 1996 that I actually went to see that tree growing in Hubei province in China. But I was watching a television program called Look Stranger, and it was all about a man or a person that had made good an industry. And this was about Archibald Aitkins, who was renting and buying land in Scotland and then reforesting it. And it was a company called Till Hill. Archibald Aitkins was the man. And at the end of the program, they said they'd do a training course in Surrey. And so I followed that up. My mother followed it up. I applied for the course. I went down for an interview. I was given a place. And in 1974, I left school to start a career in forestry with Graham Underhill, who you know very well.
I do. It's a dear friend of mine and a chartered arboriculturalist.
Exactly.
But didn't you stay in some horrible caravan or something?
Yeah, we were in caravans in the wood. They were horrible then. Well, they were horrible. They would be horrible now, but they were nice then.
Because, they were nice then. I beg
your
pardon.
You were 16 and the world was your oyster. And I loved it. We had a great time. It was during the summer of 76, that hot summer. But I then left forestry and went into arboriculture. I went to Merris Wood. I was doing City and Guilds forestry nursery practices at Merris Wood. But then I did City and Guilds horticulture during the day release. And then I switched from forestry and went to Merris Wood, as did Graham, I think. And we did the NCH arboriculture, which was a fantastic course. I think still one of the best courses I ever did. I did the RFS Cert Arb as an extra. And then Germany were looking for arborists or tree surgeons and climbers because Germans weren't allowed to climb for health and safety reasons. But they were happy for Brits to go over there and risk their lives. So about five of us, we were having a beer one night and we just said, shall we all go? And we all went. And that was a fantastic 12 months learning the ropes of arboriculture in Germany, who had the money and the resources. So, you know, we all had still O2Os, personal saws. But then while I was there, I was just thinking, do you know what? I need to broaden my outlook. I need to do a bit more. I want to do some more training. And two of my lecturers, John Whitehead and Barry Phillips at Merris Wood, were ex-Q students. And they both said, go to Q, you'll love it, and do the Q diploma, which is what I did. I did 3 years from 1978 to 81. And then at the end of that, I was offered a post in the Arboretum as a supervisor and then gradually worked my way through the system. It's in a fantastic industry and full of characters, full of great people like yourself, who are passionate about what we do. And it's an industry that is changing all the time. And those changes are made by people like, you know, you and I and other people like us who are passionate about what we do and want to make it better. And so I feel very privileged to have been a part of that industry, probably through one of the most important periods of arboriculture from, you know, Peter Bridgman's days, those first books in arboriculture from the 1960s and 70s through to what we're doing today and how fast our industry's changed, but for the better. And then last year, getting an MBE for services to arboriculture and the Royal Botanic Gardens Kew was really the icing on the cake.
I also feel immensely privileged to be an arboriculturalist at this time in history.
Exactly.
Because I think that this is one of the most important times with climate change and trees being part of the solution. And also we're having to adapt our practices as well to deal with climate change and the emerging technology and the emerging consideration of trees as part of dealing with our development and dealing with how we manage our land. And people are beginning to understand how everything is connected in a way that's not been before. So I feel enormously pleased to be alive right now, even with the global pandemic, because I feel that we have never been better connected.
Well, I remember in 2008, we were building the treetop walkway at Kew, and we needed to do root radar surveys to find out where the tree roots were going, so we could position the pylons. And even then, you know, it was pretty basic technology, but you have developed that now to an extent that we trust what we see, but also you've developed it to a state that we can understand what we see, which is a massive step in what, 12 years?
Oh, yeah.
Of understanding what's happening underground.
I mean, we were really privileged to come to Kew and to work on a project there, but you know, that's just one of the examples of all the great technology that's really running ahead now. And I've been working with Treeconomics on ecosystem services and also working with an industry friend, Luke Fay, on projecting forward canopy growth over time, working with Kieran Doik as well. So I think there's a time of enormous change, but let's just go back in time a bit now, because the 1987 gale, I slept through. I mean, I was a student at the time, so I was allowed to. But I remember waking up round a friend's house and the landlady knocking at the door with a cup of tea saying, "You're asleep. It's 8 o'clock in the morning. Don't you know what's happened?" And the enormous change that brought to our landscape. What happened at Kew?
Well, I didn't sleep through it, actually, Sharon. I was awakened by my galvanized dustbin blowing down the road. So I went to retrieve it at about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And I think the hurricane peaked at about 4 o'clock that morning. So I was just catching the brunt of it coming in. And I came back in, I said to my wife, "Blimey, it's pretty windy out there." And we lost roof tiles on our house. But then we turned the radio on in the morning, and Chris Tarrant was on Capital Radio was saying, "Do not go out. Don't go anywhere unless you have to." Well, I just thought, I've got to get into work.
You must have been worried.
I was. And what was normally a 10, 15 minute journey turned into about an hour and a half, 2 hour epic journey, driving under trees that were across the road. And I eventually got to Kew and got in, and it was just devastation. When I look back at some of the photographs now, I just wonder, you know, I mean, I was still quite young then and didn't really know Kew that well. But if it happened now, it would probably finish me off. You know, I mean, there's some things that you can cope with, some that you can't. We lost about 700 mature trees at Kew, which is about probably 10% of the collections, at 15 million across the southeast of England. So, and of course, Essex and London took, and Surrey, Sussex took the brunt of it. Then it was all doom and gloom. But when I look back now, it's probably one of the best things that ever happened in terms of the knowledge that we gained from that and the passion and awareness that it raised in trees. Suddenly, overnight, everyone became passionate about trees, you know, because they saw so many losses. And I think that stuck and we still see that today in some people.
But you also learnt something scientifically that surprised you about a tree. Was it a holm oak?
It was a Turner oak.
A Turner oak.
From Essex.
Yeah.
Raised by a nurseryman in Essex. And it was a big, it's a semi-deciduous oak, actually, but we can say, you know, almost evergreen. It does hold on to its leaves through mild winters. That entire tree, that was planted in the late 1700s, about 1790. And the entire tree lifted out of the ground. And I remember standing on the root ball the next day and part of it was sticking out of the ground, but you could see the whole thing had lifted out of the ground. It's quite a significant heritage tree. And we just thought, let's see if we can save this. So we pushed it back. And this is a big tree. We pushed it back up with acros and propped it, mulched it. And then we said, if it's dead, it'll be the last tree that we cut up. Up until then, it had been quite a tree in ill health. It wasn't in good condition. And during summer, the crown density was probably about 25-30% max. So, but then when we came back 3 years later, damn it, the tree's a picture of health. Crown density within that period, about 75%, and improving every time. The leaves were getting bigger. We just thought, this is amazing. And when we started to think about it, that tree had been suffering from compaction all these years. And that's what instigated our decompaction program at Kew, which is used all around the world now. You know, and from that comes the air spade, the vogue, all part of from what we learned during that one night.
Hello, this is Tree Lady Talks, and I'm Sharon Durden-Hollenby. All music and production is by Noel Durden-Tollenby, and all views expressed by me or the interviewees are entirely personal. And so for listeners who aren't borough culturalists, compaction is a real problem, isn't it? We're talking about people walking under a tree, and we're all told go and hug a tree and it's good for you, and of course it is. But if thousands upon thousands of people hug a tree, then the soil gets squashed and the tree cannot cope physiologically with that.
That's right. Absolutely. That's a really good summary. And of course, you know, this Miss Beasley at school, she drew me, she was showing us cartoon pictures of trees and saying, you know, what you see above ground is mirrored below ground. So we all assumed that tree, if you had a 20 meter tree with a big wide canopy 20 meters wide, that's what the root system was underground. But after the hurricane, it really sunk home then how shallow root systems were, you know, like that wine glass scenario. And as you know from all the work that you do, Sharon, that top meter is the epicenter of the root system. And once you go below that, you're through that root zone. And what we realized was that tree roots need to breathe as much as the top. The deeper you go, the more anaerobic the conditions become. Usually it becomes drier, there's less food, less nutrients, so the tree roots are staying in that top. And they compact very, very quickly.
The only exception to that, which doesn't apply to Kew, is in some very urban situations where the tree roots will exploit where they can. And sometimes that can be deep because of fissures in the ground and nutrients and sewage. But in a place like Kew, where a tree can grow in a natural environment, it will grow where it needs to get its good stuff with the least effort, and that is generally in the top meter. So that really inspired you to think about different methods of decompaction, and did you reach any sort of scientific conclusions that one method was better than the other, or was it a combination, or anything is good?
Initially, Sharon, we started with the TerraVent. Remember the good old TerraVent, which would now be a huge health and safety manual handling problem. You wouldn't be able to use it today, realistically. And then we were inoculating mycorrhiza. Mm-hmm. We were mulching and irrigating, etc. We didn't do any scientific experiments, but it was about comparing different methods on different trees. And I think today we don't inoculate with mycorrhiza. We've taken that one out. We still decompact, but we're using the air spade and the Vogue, so two machines designed to do that work. If I could only do one thing and take all the others out, I would mulch.
Yeah, and so by mulch, you're really putting down wood chip.
Yeah.
Down to about sort of 75 millimeters, sort of 3 or 4 inches. And
that's right.
And that breaks down, doesn't it?
It breaks down and you get the invertebrates, all the natural flora, all the natural fauna start to do that job for you. I mean, now I have badgers that are decompacting our trees, purely digging in the mulch for the worms because we've created the perfect environment. And I don't mind the badgers doing it because they weed it and they churn it up, they aerate. It takes a little bit longer to see results in trees purely from mulching, but you get the same effect. It may just take 2 or 3 years longer.
Getting nerdy now, mycorrhizae, which is that relationship, special fungi, and relationship with trees, you say you've stopped using that now. Tell me why. Because I'm reading Entangled Life by Merlin Sheldrake. I don't know if you've read that book yet.
I got it for Christmas.
Yeah,
so I've got to read it, but it looks amazing. It's a lovely cover
as
well.
It is, it's a great cover.
It's one of those sexy books, and because just the feel of it, you want to read it. Great, great marketing. Mycorrhiza is this friendly fungi that forms a symbiotic relationship between the tree and the fungi. The fungi needs the tree as a host. The tree needs the fungi to help it take up nutrient, water, make it more drought resistant and protect it from other aggressive fungi like our malaria, good old honey fungus. The reason I've taken the inoculation out is because we do so much mulching at Kew now, there is an absolute plethora of mycorrhizal fungi through the gardens. So it's there just lying in wait for you to make the optimum conditions for them. So then, you know, mycorrhiza fungi needs the host, organic matter and oxygen. And that's what we do by decompaction. And at somewhere like Kew, that mycorrhiza will come in naturally without me having to put it in.
And also, I really like that approach because also you're using the local mycorrhizae.
Yeah.
I sometimes worry, and this is where I'm not speaking from a scientific basis particularly, but if we're inoculating with mycorrhizae that is purchased, and there is a place for that, but in somewhere like Kew, it might be the equivalent of putting in wildebeest into an Arctic ecosystem. We don't know if we're putting in fungi that would be recognised by the tree population or not. Now, I say I'm no expert on that. I think there is a place for that in really impoverished urban soils.
I totally agree. And I think, I don't, again, I'm not a scientist. I'm a practitioner.
Yeah, same as me.
And we're quite resourceful and observant. And I think that's why, you know, we like doing what we do. So we're, you know, we're looking to see what's the best, you know, what works. I think a lot of the mycorrhizae that we put in dies anyway. I don't think it survives if it takes. Probably by the time that's happened, the natural mycorrhizae come in and already established. And so, for example, the best place to plant a tree is in a woodland because the World Wide Web is there already underground. And as soon as you put a tree in a woodland, it's going to tap into that natural mycorrhizal supply and grow away with that. So I'm a real fan of mulching, and I love trying different mulches. So, for example, now I've just had 2,500 Christmas trees delivered from suppliers in London. So all the trees that weren't sold, we have now. We've shredded. We've done a triple shred. So they've gone through the shredder three times. They're now in a windrow composting, and that makes the best acid mulch for us, because you know a lot of our ground now is becoming very alkaline because of the compost that we're putting in. So by using composted Christmas trees, we're decreasing the pH in our soil, which we need to do in some places.
Actually, you've made a really good point there, because a lot of very urban sites are very alkali as well because of all the concrete and all the hardcore and actually that's a really good case for using an acidic mulch. I'm going to incorporate that. That's brilliant. And you also talked about how trees support each other. And that's another thing that's really been captured in the public mind about this connection between trees and trees sharing resources. And you can speak to most people now, most ordinary folks in the street, and they'll have some understanding of that. I speak to a lot of landscape architects, and I think there's a real understanding there of how we need to start planting trees together in shared tree pits where we can, even if above ground, it looks like they're isolated singular trees. And now we've got all these wonderful sort of underground systems we can do that with. Aside from the technical stuff, I want to go back in time again. It's winter, it's been raining and snowing, and we're all locked down. Can you take us on a fantasy journey back to one of your wonderful expeditions? Where have you been? Tell us where you've been. I'm sure it's a long list.
My first trip was to Chile in 1985. That was to see the monkey puzzles and Fitzroy's, a fantastic flora, fantastic trees, a lot of which, you know, we would have struggled to grow 40 years ago, but today, when I, you know, not the monkey puzzle, but some of the more unusual tree species in Chile we would have struggled to grow, but now we can grow them pretty well with the techniques that we're using. But Chile was a 6 to 8 week expedition where I lost about three lives. I flew out, and Pinochet was in charge. So there were military coups and curfews on. There was a lot of problems. We were based on an Air Force base, which wasn't the best place to be. And then we decided to leave Santiago and get south as quickly as possible. There was a massive earthquake the day that we left Santiago that killed thousands.
Gosh.
And we weren't aware of. And then I went down with Salmonella typhoid that I caught in the British Embassy in Santiago. So that was all in about 3 days of a 6 week expedition. But I recovered, and the expedition went on, and I loved it. You know, I mean, that even despite all that, what I saw was amazing. And when we go on these expeditions, we're observing plant association, how plants grow together. So, you know, you were saying earlier, Sharon, about how trees work together in a woodland.
Mm-hmm.
you know, we're looking at that when we go into these forests collecting trees. After the hurricane in 1987, we started to look at a plant exploration program. And we started to look at geographical weaknesses and taxonomic weaknesses in our collection. So, you know, different species of trees that we didn't have, but also the different countries that we didn't have those trees from. My first expedition from there was South Korea in 1989, and Taiwan 1992, the Russian Far East, Sakhalin Island 1994, China 1996, Hokkaido, Japan 97. I spent a lot of time in China, which is an amazing place, but seen some incredible trees, and I've been so privileged. It makes you more passionate, it makes you more hungry, and you start to see, as I said earlier, how trees grow together. But also, I then wrote the George Round book on tree pruning, because looking at all these trees in woodlands, I then realized that we are pruning trees to grow how we want them to grow and how we expect them to grow. But actually, that's not how they want to grow. And sometimes we're really forcing them into a situation that they don't want to do. And I think our pruning techniques have changed. Well, they have changed a lot since then. But also, there's more of a tendency for natural pruning now to grow trees, multi-stemmed, etc., how they would grow better in the natural habitat. But I think probably one of my favorite expeditions, they're all good, was 1996 to China. We went to a place called Dabishan, where no Westerners had been before, so we had to get special permission from the local mayors to go into some of the towns. And I had a red beard and a red head. Of course, I was a real oddity in China, so people were coming and looking at me, touching my beard. But some of the trees that we discovered on that expedition that are growing now in the gardens, it was probably one of the richest areas that I've ever been to in terms of different tree species. And we were soon moved on by the authorities. We have all the permissions and things, but we had to move on, and it was like, well, you know, what do we do? We were driving back to Chengdu, and our driver said, oh, we could go on a 4 or 5 day detour and look at some key trees. So I said, what like? He said, well, would you like to see the original Metsequoia glyptostriboides? And I was like, God, that's the first tree I learned. Yes, I would. And of course, all the trees that are growing in cultivation today are from the one tree in a town called Modaoqi in Hubei province. So off we went, and there it was. It looks nothing like what we know as Metsequoia, mainly because it's suffering from compaction. It's in an urban setting now, in a village. But of course, you know, the new kid on the block, only discovered in 1941 and introduced in 1948. And then for me to be my first tree to learn, but then actually see it. And now it's the most widely planted tree in the world, you know, probably the most commonly planted urban tree in the world, and certainly one for the future. And then we went on to see a tree called Cathaya, which wasn't in cultivation. No Westerners had seen it before, growing in Juzhaigou province near Chongqing. And we were under armed guards, two armed guards to each of us, to ensure that we didn't take any plant material from it, which we wouldn't have done anyway without permissions. But to see it was an amazing experience. And to know that you're one of the first Westerners to see it in the bark. And then 2 years later, 1998, a professor in China released seeds. He realized it needed to be in botanic gardens and collections. And we have one of the original, those first trees growing in the gardens here that I was given by the Forest Commission from Dan Luscombe in Bedgebury. And it's one of my favorite trees. I love it. If ever anyone comes to queue for a tree walk with me, they will always end up at the Cathaya. And since then, it's flowered. We've pollinated it. And we now have our first offsprings from that, first generation seedlings from that, that we planted last year out in the garden. So already we're starting to build up a bank, like the Metsequoia, of trees of that, and building the population up ex situ. So which is really important for conservation and preserving that tree species. you know, I love travel, I love trees, and I've been very lucky with Q to be able to do that with my job.
You've also been involved with a lot of filming, various shows. Perhaps you could talk about some of your film experiences, including the wonderful Dame Judi Dench as well.
Yeah, well, we had the first experience was filming with BBC Two. We did a documentary called A Year at Kew, which was fantastic. Basically showing everybody what we actually do at work. So we were mic'd up in the morning, and none of it was staged. It was live filming and recording, which was good. And then what happened was on TV, it was very popular, and everybody liked the arboriculture and the tree side of the program. And BBC approached me and said, we'd like to do a series on trees called The Trees That Made Britain. Would you present it? Which I did. That was about 8 half-hour programs. That was successful. So we did a second series. And then, you know, opportunities have come up since then, like filming A Passion for Trees with Dame Judi Dench, who's now become a very close friend. And she is passionate about trees. She has quite a large garden. And sadly, anyone that dies, she plants a tree for them. So she walks around the garden and says, you know, this is such a body, this is such a body. And they're trees. And then I went to Borneo with her to film the Borneo experience, which was, again, out of my zone because it was all tropical. But coincidentally, a couple of months before that, Oxford University discovered the tallest tropical tree in the world in the Danone Valley where we were filming. So they asked me if I wanted to go in and see it, which I did. And it was just an amazing experience to see that tree. Menara, it's called, which means tower in Malaysian. And you know what? I suddenly became fond of tropical trees. I've never been a lover of tropical trees because there are so many. I just don't know what they are. And I remember going to the herbarium and meeting Tim Uttridge, one of the scientists who specialized in dipterocarps. And I said, I'm going to Malaysia, to Sabah. Can you teach me how to identify the dipterocarps? And he went, well, I've been studying them all my life and I still don't know which is which. And there are so many and you'll never see them because the canopy is so high up. You end up looking on the ground to see what's fallen, and that's how you know what you're walking under. I think all these things fire up and fuel our passion and eagerness to learn more.
Definitely, that's been my experience. I haven't travelled anything like as much as you, but when I have, it's just been mind expanding. That's absolutely wonderful. And looking back at your time at Kew, which you said before we started recording, 42 years, which seems extraordinary. Could you have imagined that you'd be planting the species now that you're planting? Has climate change changed your planting palette? I know, obviously, you're an arboretum, so you would be planting trees from other parts of the world anyway, but have there been any changes?
Massive changes, Sharon, and in terms of, you know, let's say 40 years. 40 years in a tree, in the life of a tree, an era of a tree is just a snippet, you know, it's a day in our life. I'm planting trees outside now that we couldn't plant 40 years ago, even things like Taiwania, which is a conifer from Taiwan. Beautiful conifer, lovely, graceful, very close to Cryptomeria, the Japanese redwood. Well, you know, we grew that in the temperate house because it needed winter protection. Now, since 1992, I've got several growing outside that have now made big, substantial trees and are, you know, perfectly hardy in our climate now. We've been collecting in Vietnam, so a lot of material from Vietnam it can be quite tender, but we're able to grow that now comfortably. What we don't want is a beast from the east every year, so we need them to get established and get some wood on them, and they'll be better. There's an Aeschylus, a horse chestnut from Vietnam, a new species called Aeschylus wangii. Wang is Chinese for king, so it's the king of the conkers, and the conker is about the size of a tennis ball. And we're growing that outside, you know, and you would never have been able to grow that outside 40 years ago. So the tide has turned, and I'm not a lover of planting lots of new tender species. And the reason for that is I like to see trees establish and I'd like to think that they will grow to their maturity and make big trees. So if I planted something that's slightly tender and then we get a lot of bees from the east and they die, that would break my heart. You know, I just think that's a wasted time. So I'm very cautious about tender species that I plant here at Kew, but I'm dipping my toe in the water a bit more now, and you know, where I feel more confident. So yes, the climate is changing. I don't talk about climate change so much, more seasonal change. So we used to have four seasons, now we have two. So spring and summer merge into one, and autumn winter merges into one. And there's no clear definition of those seasonal changes like there used to be when I was in my early years, you know.
Yeah, me too. I remember that as well. Have you noticed any trees in the last 40 years which are not doing as well because of the change in the seasons?
Yeah, things like beech. I think beech is finding it really hard. And I think 1976 was probably a turning point for beech in the south of England, when they all went down with beech bark disease because of that hot summer. And I don't think they've ever really recovered from that. You know, maybe some root damage. Maripolis has been a big killer of it. The 1976 hot summer and then the 1987 storm with root tearing, etc. I think Maripolis has had a bit of a beano. So, you know, I've seen the beech slowly disappear. Obviously, the elms, when I came into arboriculture, the elms had gone. So I missed those. But of course, there's a revival now. We're all planting elms, these resistant elms. I'm replacing ash in our woodland with elm. And who would have thought of that?
Well, I never. What some cultivars are you planting?
New Horizon is one, and then a lot of the ones that I'm using are numbered cultivars from European trials. So we're trialing them, but they've all been inoculated. They should all be resistant, and I think we'll see a lot more coming into the tree nurseries. Like I know Hilliers are doing a lot more with elms now, which is fantastic. You know,
and talking of planting. As it's an arboretum, presumably you can't plant whips.
I do. No, I do actually, Sharon. I like to plant young trees. I do plant semi-matures in some places, like the vistas and in the heritage landscape where I need immediate impact. But my favourite size is whip size for most of the trees.
How do you plant a tree, Tony?
Well, again, since 1987, when we started doing all the expeditionary work, one of the things that I was aware of was that we needed to be spot on with our planting. You know, we needed to, if we planted a tree that we'd travel to Russia or Japan or China to collect, we needed it to establish. We'd put a lot of work, we put our lives on the edge to collect these, so we needed them to establish. So I started to review tree planting techniques, and if I'm honest, we weren't good. Not just Kew, but generally. In the UK, our establishment success rates were very, very low. I started to look at research from North America, from Europe, from Australia, pulled it all together. And there's absolutely tons of material, but no one was using it. I'm a believer in having specifications, and I designed a planting specification for Kew. And I would recommend anyone that is doing tree planting work, especially contract work, etc., to have a specification so you know how that tree is planted and don't rely on everyone to know how to plant a tree.
No, you're right. Never assume. There's a wonderful British standard out, BS 8545, but that's not in everybody's library. And it's not necessarily in the cab of the guy who's going to, or the girl who's going to plant the tree. So simple instructions is a great idea.
I then played around and did a lot of experimental work, and I'm very anti-tree staking. I don't do any tree staking at Kew unless I really have to. And we plant about 150, 200 trees a year. I get very despondent when I watch television programs and read articles that say every young tree must be staked. And I think you have to assess every situation separately and be prescriptive.
Do you have any predators such as rabbits and hares at Kew?
Squirrels and muntjac are our main predator. I mean, when I did RFS Cert Arb, I remember I had to plant a tree for the practical, and we dug a 3-foot deep hole that was perfectly round, took the turf off, took the topsoil out, took the subsoil out, forked over the bottom, put the turf in upside down, put the subsoil back, and then couldn't get any of the topsoil back because, you know, physics doesn't allow you to do it. After the hurricane, there were no tree roots deeper than 3 foot. So I'm thinking, why are we digging 3 foot down? And then what happens? You plant your tree, everything settles, the ground shrinks, and it pulls the tree down, then the tree pits are topped up, and then your tree's too deep. There was a good guy called Carl Whitcomb, and he wrote a book called Landscape Tree Establishment, which was, I think, his PhD, and it was fantastic. It was things that he'd observed, and he was talking about planting shallow and digging pits wider. I don't like calling them pits now because everyone assumes it's got to be big and deep. Our standard tree pit now, planting pit, is 1.2 meters diameter, which is one of the optimum sizes, I think, from research through the Forest Commission for establishment. And we dig the spit of a spade deep, that's all. So really quick. And all the you'll see all the holes are circles at Kew. But actually, underneath, all our planting pits are square, because I then realized that, you know, what's the weakest port? By digging these circles, you're creating a container underground. And then all of us are saying, well, we don't like trees in containers because they have circling roots. But all we were doing was expanding that and creating a container underground. And the weakest part of a hole is a corner, but there are no corners in a circle. So we started digging square holes. And so we don't put compost in. So what soil comes out goes back in. No soil ameliorants. But once it's finished planting, we mulch. And then the tree can take that down as it needs it. At the same time, harness any moisture in there and prevent weed competition. I think one of the critical parts of that operation is the planting depth. And a lot of people plant too deep, and that will kill the tree. And it's a long, slow death. But basically, the tree never really establishes, and it leads ultimately to failure. So that's how we plant a tree. And if I could not stake, I won't stake. Because we all say, yeah, we'll adjust the ties. You know, we'll do short staking that was invented by Derek Patch. And I was a part of those trials at Marriswood when I was a student. So if we do stake, we should be using best staking practice, which Derek Patch came up with, you know, third the overall height of the tree, single tie, no more than an inch from the top of the stake. But none of us do that. So, and none of us adjust the tie. You know, we forget it. And how many trees, especially urban trees, do you see with tree stakes still attached 10, 15, 20 years after the tree's been planted?
And being strangled, you know, I sort of go around with a penknife sometimes, you know, and just make a slit because it's just unbearable. So, Tony, what's next at Kew?
Generally for Kew this year, our festival is, it's called The Secret World of Plants. So we're creating six habitats, threatened habitats, and creating six displays that are on legs, so you can go under and pop up in these displays. So you can immerse yourself, you know, you can come up in a moorland and you'll have heather all around you, and providing COVID doesn't get in the way, that will come off. We're planting an azalea garden in the center of the Arboretum. Two or three years ago, we planted cherries and Japanese maples to create a backdrop, which is just starting to form a good backbone now. And then we'll underplant that with the azaleas. Although I say so myself, it is an amazing place, Kew. You know, I mean, it has changed so much since I first came. But that's the beauty of Kew, that, you know, we never stop. And we're always pushing and promoting, you know, the latest technology, the latest ideas. So it's never a dull moment.
And for those who are listening outside of the UK, which I know is about half of our listeners, do go on to the Kew website because it's absolutely fantastic and you get a real sense. And if you come to the UK when this is all over, head off to Kew Gardens because every visit is different. There is so much to do. What's your dream scenario?
The scenario that I'd like to see is I'd like to see more people coming into our industry. I'd like to see it continue to grow, and that we continue training and getting more people through with the same passion that I see in so many of us that are in that network. And, you know, if there's any young people, or, you know, whatever age, that are thinking of coming into arboriculture, don't be put off by it. It is an incredible industry, an incredible world. It's good for your well-being. You know, we all have good days and bad days, but you know, if you can go out and get close to trees and get a really good feeling, let's, you know, promote our industry more.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, it's absolutely a fabulous career.
Yes.
So many of us in our industry are working hard to encourage young people to get involved with arboriculture. And not just that, because we're in an economic recession at the moment, but people have very sadly been made redundant and we're looking to start again in a new career. Come into arboriculture or forestry or ecology or work outside. We need you. There's a skill shortage. And finally, Tony, what's your favourite tree?
It varies from season to season, but I think one of my all-time favourites has got to be the Chinese tulip tree. It's what I call a really well-behaved tree. It's a hard-working tree, and I promote trees. For me, have got to be hard-working, so they've got to do, you know, they're not just there for ornamental beauty, but they've got to achieve a lot of things. You know, it's well-behaved, it's straight, strong. Beautiful leaf, nice flower, good autumn colour, good story behind it. So, yeah, Chinese tulip tree. But then I could say, you know, and I don't want to put anyone off here, but, you know, one of my all-time favourite trees is a sycamore.
Yeah, it's such a survivor. It's so useful.
It's a fantastic tree. It's one of those denizens of the highlands and north. Growing where no other tree grows. And there's a lot of people that, you know, say, oh, it shouldn't be here. You know, it's introduced, it damages woodlands and things. But actually there's some areas, certainly in the north, in, you know, Lancashire, Yorkshire, etc., where nothing else would grow. And if we didn't have the sycamore there, it would be a dull place. But also it's a tree, it's got to be a tree of the future. It's just, you know, it's a survivor. There are no pests and diseases. And we need to be planting more shade trees, big trees, and the sycamore is certainly one on my list.
Yes, it's going to be about canopy cover in our urban environments rather than tree numbers. So absolutely, that is fantastic, Tony. I could talk to you all day long, and I know you're very, very busy, but it's been an absolute privilege, and you inspire us with your books as well. We haven't even touched upon those, but we'll put some links to those on our website. So thanks again.
Thank you, Sharon. Absolute pleasure.
I love that story about the first tree name that he ever said.
I love that. It's really touching. And isn't it interesting to hear about how people started out? And that you don't have to come from a family of tree people to forge a career in our wonderful profession. He's just so down to earth. And like Tony, I agree, we really need more people to come into working with trees and wildlife.
Well, I mean, certainly, if there's a guy who can get people working in trees, he's got to be it. He really has got to be it. I mean, I would phone him up right now and say, do you know what? Can I just come and do a little bit of an apprenticeship with Q? I think he'd probably say, yes, why not?
I think that would be a sight to behold.
I think it would. I mean, you know, don't put it past me. I might still do it. I might still do it. I can. Oh, is that the phone ringing? I think it might be Tony now. No, sorry, false alarm. Who's next?
We're speaking to Professor Ian Bateman, who's a keynote speaker at the Trees, People and Built Environment Conference, which is coming up really soon.
February the 3rd, February the 4th.
That's it. Get your tickets now. Honestly, there's going to be so many people there. It's super exciting. On the evening of the 3rd of February, at the end of the first day of the conference, there's going to be a special event, a fireside chat. I mean, it's a virtual interview, but actually I will be by our fireside. And we're going to be interviewing Richard Louvre, who's an American non-fiction author and journalist. I'm reading his book, Our Wild Calling. It's absolutely fascinating. It's about how animals communicate with each other, to their own species, other species, and to us, and how we communicate back. And really looking at things from the animal point of view. It certainly made me look at Compo the Golden Retriever in a different light. I mean, I can't wait to talk to him. It's going to be brilliant and live.
Wow, I hope I get involved in that little conversation because I'd quite like to know some of the things that our dog gets up to. However, that's for another day. In that case, there's nothing else for us to say, is there, I don't think?
Well, thank you so much for listening.
And we'll see you next time on Tree Lady Talks. And you can find us on Facebook at Sharon Hosegood Associates.
Twitter at the Tree Lady 67.
Instagram.
Tree Lady Talks. So please tell your friends and colleagues about this podcast because we are growing and growing all around the world and it's all about the conversations and how they might make a change.
We'll see you next time.
It's goodbye from him.
Goodbye from me. Thank you, the two Ronnies. We'll speak to you later.
Bye.
Bye.